There's this problem. We don't know enough to predict where we really should push hardest all the time. And I think that scientists have got a poor idea that this is a sophisticated argument, the argument that you're better off doing, choosing things that scientists choose because they're interested in them and they do them well, will give you a good sampling of what's available out there, of you'll be pushing out at the limits of what can be done, because you don't know enough ahead of time a priori to know what's in the unknown out here that's going to be useful. If we knew what the unknown was, it wouldn't be unknown.
How does the genome project fit into this? What's your views on that?
Well, I think that it's a perfectly reasonable thing to have a map. But to some extent, I think the genome project is a boondoggle in the sense that it's something we can do with big science. We can spend a lot of money on it, but we don't necessarily know there will be lots of unknown benefits from doing it. If you push anything hard enough, something will be interesting about it. But it's the cost is that we are not trying on any other level. That we have this one very narrow range of approaches that we're taking to the problems of human biology or biology in general, that means that we're foregoing, there's an opportunity cost in doing this, and we're foregoing all this other range of approaches. Now, the entire nematode genome project has been done by a very small laboratory. Very small genome, one thing, so that the opportunity cost of having John Sulston do nematodes has not been great. And in fact, the benefit has been great. And the reason the benefit of having a map and a contiguous set of clones has been great is not just because he had a map and the clones, but because the classical nematode genetics is great enough, is good enough, and powerful enough that you can localize any given gene to within two or three clones in the lambda map. But the human genetics are not that good. And so that having a set of contigs would mean that everything's cloned and you can approximately position it and maybe start working on the right sort of way, but not necessarily. I'm not convinced that the opportunity cost is worth the benefits. There would be great benefits, but there's an opportunity cost, and we can never know what we've given up. You can't really know what you've missed. You didn't get it.
We've talked some about the funding picture. What has the Pew Award meant to you? Has the money been...
Peace of mind. It meant that at least for these 4 years, there's been some pool of money sitting there that really, that at least I knew that was there. That I got the Pew money before I got my first NIH grant, and I got, and it extended through the third, following through my second one. I was waiting for the second one to start up. So that was really reassuring at both ends. I actually had an interesting discussion. The first dinner I had at a Pew meeting, I had dinner with Tom Caskey, who was talking about how wonderful the Human Genome Project was going to be, and this was going to be a whole new pot of money and it wouldn't cost giants. And Aaron and I were sitting there, and Aaron said, well, I don't think that's true. You know, I think there's going to be, it's taking a lot of money. I said, of course it's going to be a whole new pot of money. It's going to be the greatest thing that ever happened for science. And of course, Tom was wrong. It really wasn't a whole new pot of money. It's money that's been taken away from other things. And Aaron and I were both agreeing that the key fact for the Pew money really wasn't the first year, it was that fourth year. It was knowing that you at least had something at the end of your that if the NIH got worse, and it did. And it was not great when I was applying for my first grant, and certainly wasn't better when it was worse than when I was applying for my second grant.
And the intangibles of the Pew Award?
Well, I already talked about the annual meeting for the Whitney Foundation. I think that the annual meeting for the Pew Foundation serves much of the same purpose. Again, a set of people that I wouldn't have met otherwise, that I now know all over the country, that I can call them up and say, you know, we were Pew Fellows together, you know, can we talk about this? Do you know something about this? Let me ask you about it. And the funny thing is that it works even just in town. So, for example, Glenn Monroe, who's up at Scripps Clinic, was interested in one point. He had a question about Drosophila. Now, he never would have called me if he hadn't known that I was a Pew Fellow, but he thought perfectly reasonable calling me up. given that I was a Pew Scholar. He just calls up and said, how do you do this? How does this work? And so that really makes a big difference. Makes a difference that way. It gives you access to people that that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And means that I know people all over now that I wouldn't have known. And we're good people. We'll be good people for a long time, I think. And I think that the intention of the foundation, at least, is to continue trying to keep people who are out of the program still connected with it, to have some idea who's coming in and who's going out, and the mailing list will include all the old fellows, and so that they really, one will know a lot about the whole thing. I mean, so those things are real benefits. And people say, well, why don't we just fund another scholar? This is too much time to spend on this. I think that that's wrong. I think that, in fact, the meetings are worth the cost in terms of the benefits to the people who are going to, the chance to get to meet other people and to find out what they're doing, to see them later on. I'm a strong believer in the meetings, a very strong believer in the meetings as being valuable scientific exercises.
How many scientific meetings do you attend in a year?
Well, there was a while I was just going to one or two. Now I'm going to quite a larger number, so that, but how many have I gone to this year? There's the Pew meeting. I was at a small meeting in Florida. I was at a meeting, a signals and development meeting, one of the UCLA meetings this spring. I was supposed to be going to a Roden conference last week, but pulled out of that because my kid was being born. Going to a Gordon conference later this summer, going to a FASIG meeting this summer, going to a EMBO meeting at the end of the summer. So, quite a few.
Is the Pew meeting the most broad gauge or not?
Probably the most broad gauge, yes. There are a lot of the meetings. A Gordon conference is really not particularly narrow. The Gordon Conference on Development, the Developmental Biology Gordon Conference, covers a wide range of topics in development. So it's not particularly narrow. The Pew meeting is broader than that, given that it's not really constrained to development, so that it's a meeting of a fairly broad scope, maybe the broadest scope. Certainly the chance to see the most young scientists talking about the most different things.
One last thing that we want to touch on has to do with documentation. Are you saving your professional correspondence, your notebooks, your old grant proposals, that type of thing, in any systematic way?
Did you step into my office? I have every notebook I've ever had. I have the notebooks I've kept as an undergraduate. I have the class notes I took as an undergraduate, but I certainly have the science notebooks I kept as an undergraduate. I have all the scientific correspondence, most of the scientific correspondence I've ever had, at least most of it that was anything that was hard copy. So I have it. It's not particular. It's filed in pseudo-chronological order, meaning I've just thrown it in there one after another as they come. But it's there if you ever care to sort through it. I must admit I've become... now that I know the Secret Service at any time could come in and inspect my notebooks, I've been worried about whether I use the same ink twice on the same page. I think they're all there.
We just want to encourage you to continue to keep things, and should space become a problem,
I can mail them to you?
Consult an archivist, either an archivist at your institution, or you can consult the Beckman Center on how to save and on what to save, rather than just throwing stuff away to make space.
Yeah, I generally kept most of my correspondence. The one thing that tends to grow on you is drafts of things. If you're writing papers, you get lots and lots of drafts. And what do you do with those? And so some of those tend to get thrown out when something. I have kept some of them just to try to remind me what I was thinking about ahead of time, but not necessarily successfully.
Well, grant proposals are also very useful documentation.
It's true, because they tell you what you were thinking about at the time. And
published papers only tell you what the results were and doesn't tell you much about the process that got you there.
Unless the grant proposal tells you much about the process either. The grant proposal tells you what you think you can get funded to do. The process is the little note that I sometimes just try to write down why I'm about to do something. We're thinking this might work, and if this didn't work for this reason, or this is what we're thinking about. So I try to write that down. That tells me more what I'm thinking about today than some other things. And so that may not be but I'm not sure the grant proposal is, it gives some idea of how one starts or how the techniques that are in the fields have changed from day to day. But doesn't necessarily really change, doesn't tell you when you first thought of this new and interesting idea. In fact, although some things you actually could trace, there's something, when I was a graduate, when I was postdoc in Bruce's lab, I hadn't been there very long, he had a grant proposal due. We hadn't even cloned transformer at that point. If we had, we didn't know we had. And talking about certain kinds of mutations one should be able to make in the tube, and then as a way of analyzing the structure of the pathway. And so Bruce asked us all to think about something and write it up. And so that was a section that I thought of while I was thought of, suggested we could do such and such and so into an experiment. And ended up putting that into my own grant proposal later, that we didn't get a chance to do it in Bruce's lab, and didn't know enough to have done it correctly until we got here. Put it in my own grant proposal. And I'm not sure that it was even particularly well received by the reviewers, but in fact it was the key to an entire paper. Eventually, when we finally did the experiment, it was the key to an entire paper here, because it allowed us to, not only was it, the result itself was flashy, but it actually allowed us to do a particular kind of a genetic analysis that defined how the hierarchy worked in a way you couldn't with the otherwise existing mutants.
Let me ask you about one last domain, which is that of biotechnology, and which is all up and down the road here. Do you have any personal links into the biotech world?
I know people who are in biotech companies, but I don't have any formalized links to them, no.
You don't consult or?
Not for my own money, but it turns out that I did have talked a little bit. The people at General Atomic were interested in some things about making spectrophotometers or things to use in spectrophotometers and ways of analyzing the physics of DNA. And turns out that for a couple of summers I had the daughter of the director of research for General Atomic working in my laboratory. And she wasn't in my lab because she was his daughter. She happened to be in my lab, and then I found out that he was this director. And so one of his, so she said, is it okay if this guy calls you? He's interested in microwave absorption of DNA. So he just wanted to say, he was a physicist, he didn't know anything about DNA, but he knew something about polymers. He just wanted to talk about DNA and things that might mimic it as polymers and might mimic it. So I talked with him some, but never a formal consulting kind of agreement.
Has the presence of these biotech companies affected SALT, the community here? I mean, do you see any impact or not?
Very little, much less than I understand people at Scripps see. But we're pretty much insulated from those. There's some people here who are involved with companies, but I don't think it yet affects the kinds of science they do in their labs. So Ron Evans has some agreements with certain local companies, and those may, to some extent, there are things that they're trying to get patents on that I think as postdocs, maybe postdocs and graduate students, may be having to spend some time dealing with that instead of being at the bench. But in general, we haven't seen it really distorting the way we would do science here. I think that there, I think maybe this is the way it is everywhere. Everybody says, oh, that, we're fine, but that other guy, he's cheating. Or that other guy, he's distorted. But the impression I have is that at Scripps, they have much greater industrial power, and that they spend much more time worrying about how they do something with regard to industry. Is this something that the industry will be able to use? Is this something we'll be able to make money on? Much more than we do here. So that may just be the perception of the other guy. Oh, we're fine, but that other guy's, well, be okay, but I'd look out for that guy. Everybody's saying that. I don't know, but even people who are here now who are at Scripps say that it's much less pressured by that kind of outside pressure.
So you really don't think it'd make any difference to you personally if they all disappear tomorrow?
No, I think it's nice to have them here. I think it's nice to have them here. It again increases the pool of scientists in San Diego, makes San Diego an attractive place for other people to come do science. And so in terms of what it does to our immediate interactions here, I don't think that they don't hurt us the way they might. And I think they actually help us. They're places where they encourage other scientists to be in San Diego. They do sort of strengthen the number of places that that postdocs who are leaving the lab can try to go. So in those senses, it's a good thing to have them around. And I think there's always the possibility, and one likes to hold out the possibility, that if you did have something that actually might, by chance, to have to be commercially reasonable, there might be some way to apply it.
Have you had postdocs
going
to biotech?
Well, I have one right now, this very moment, who's off interviewing in a biotech company. One in the area. So he's interviewed at a couple places here and he's looked for that. I think that more and more in the future, that's where postdocs are going to go. We're going to see more and more postdocs going to biotech companies rather than going into academics.
Do you view that as a failure, a success, or is something else again?
Something else again. I think it's better that it's not the same as doing necessarily the only experiment you wanted, but it's closer to doing what you wanted than being a gardener or doing some other things. Making some use of what we've done. I think there's nothing wrong with working in industry, and it's a perfectly reasonable thing. So that I don't think they're necessarily tainted by having worked in industry. We get in trouble when we start to think of ourselves as a priesthood, I think.
Covered what we need to.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a lot.